Hi, this is Ian Fletcher reading from my book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, What Should Replace It, and Why. I'm going to begin by reading from the foreword by Edward Luckback. Until the economic debacle of 2008, the power and moral authority of the United States were sustained not only by its political values, cultural magnetism, and military strength, but also by its wealth. From its investment capacity as home of the world's most sophisticated financial system, to its purchasing power as the world's largest importer, the U.S. had an undoubted primacy. When the latter finally ruined the former, for huge trade deficits tolerated for decades must decapitalize as well as deindustrialize, American diplomacy suddenly had to function without much of its accustomed leverage. Some Americans have always been displeased by the magnitude of American power, probably because they project onto the nation at large their own moral discomfort with its exercise. For them, as for assorted dictators, Islamic fanatics, and the few serious communists still breathing, the present weakening of the United States is welcome. But for others, including this writer, this weakening provokes an unwelcome question. How much power can the United States retain without this leverage? And what kind of Hobbesian world order will we face in its absence? Whatever complaints of competence or intent one may lodge against this power, the world contains alternative hegemons with far fewer scruples. A weakened American economy will embolden the enemies not only of the United States, but of a stable world generally, especially in Latin America, the Middle East, and East Asia. One early sign of America's weakening economic leverage was the refusal of allies like France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands to cooperate with the expansionary measures of the newly arrived Obama administration in early 2009. With global economic activity sinking as declining demand dragged down production, further reducing demand, only a Keynesian jolt of public spending or tax cuts could break the downward spiral. This much was agreed by all serious players, but every major European government save Britain refused to join with the United States in implementing such measures. Instead, they tacitly proposed to let others carry the burdens of reflation, mainly increased public debt and inflation risk, knowing full well that their own exporters would nonetheless benefit from the resulting increase in global demand. Above all, these allies could not be brought to heel with the threat of tariffs, quotas, capital controls, or other protectionist measures. This was America's natural card to play, but ruled out by an elite consensus rigidly opposed to any form of protectionism. This consensus, unshared with ordinary voters, prohibits even the milder forms of protectionism permitted under international agreements. Instead, it has a puritanical horror of the very concept, which refuses to view protectionism as just another form of economic realpolitik, to be coldly evaluated according to its merits and costs. Instead, it is seen as a repudiation of the twin cardinal virtues of competition and openness. This is a fact of which both America's friends and enemies are well aware, and upon which America's commercial rivals base their own neo-mercantilist trade policies. The result has been a prolonged failure to safeguard the American economy, especially manufacturing, from foreign predation. The most obvious tactic here has been currency manipulation, but this is only the tip of an iceberg whose size America's rulers still do not appear fully to comprehend. This currency manipulation, involving as it does a tidal wave of cheap foreign capital propping up the dollar by soaking up American debt and assets, has in recent years helped keep interest rates in the U.S. abnormally low. It thus helped enable the speculative property and mortgage bubbles which led to the financial collapse of 2008. Thus, many of America's recent problems, both visibly trade-related and otherwise, are ultimately linked with an underlying trade problem. This book, unlike many previous critiques of free trade, is no mere sulk about the harsh realities of capitalism, or an extended analytical misunderstanding of what those realities are. Ian Fletcher, in fact, unequivocally favors capitalism, if perhaps more broadly shared in its prosperity, more Fordist, as in the $5 day, less dogmatic about free markets, better supported by industrial policy, and less decadently plutarchic than today. He favors free markets wherever the evidence vindicates them. These remain the sovereign cure for mediocrity and sloth, whose dynamism creates wealth and compels improvements in management, production, and distribution. Free markets stimulate innovation, the ultimate root of economic growth. All these facts this book comprehends, which should slow its dismissal by the usual suspects. Devotees of free trade celebrate its advantages for American consumers. These are real enough. And even industry-destroying free trade can sometimes do good by shutting down inefficient domestic production that misuses labor and capital, freeing up resources for the industries of tomorrow. But free traders celebrate these advantages and then just stop, as if Americans could be consumers and nothing but, and as if destroying obsolete industries did not beg the question of what is to replace them. The vitality of America's underlying industrial base is either ignored or papered over with questionable economic theory, if not sheer ideological hectoring. This is where Fletcher comes into his own, for he pries open the dogmatic black box of free trade economics. Despite the myth that serious economics vindicates free trade simpliciter, he shows in meticulous detail how the mechanisms which supposedly vindicate unlimited free trade under all circumstances are in fact dubious intellectual contraptions predicated upon unrealistic assumptions. The presumption of free and unmanipulated currency markets is only the most obvious example. There are many others. Fletcher also elucidates recent theoretical breakthroughs in economics that are finally bringing realism into the doctrinaire mathematical world of academic trade economics, advances that are undermining the intellectual respectability of conventional free trade theory as now commonly understood. These days, some of the leading practitioners of free trade, the chief executives of the largest U.S. corporations, are also quietly starting to reverse course. They, too, now proclaim that the United States must manufacture more and export more manufactured goods. Certain well-known firms are bellwethers of this change. For example, over the past 15 years, Boeing executives made many a speech celebrating the globalization of their company's manufacturing operations. They tirelessly invoked free trade's logic of comparative advantage to explain why they dismissed American engineers and production workers while Boeing's risk-sharing partners were increasing employment overseas. They strove to impress Wall Street analysts with their periodic downsizings of thousands of workers at a time. These efforts to transfer manufacturing and design overseas were crowned in the 787 Dreamliner, whose wing box and wings were made in Japan, and whose composite fuselage was mostly made in Italy, leaving little for the United States but final assembly. That overseas production might be cheaper merely because of subsidies by foreign governments seeking a foothold in this lucrative and strategic industry was irrelevant to Boeing, which is not responsible for the economy at large, but merely a business run for profit. But Boeing's self-congratulation came to a sudden halt when the entire 787 program was crippled by devastating development delays, most caused by gross manufacturing errors overseas. The company had to change course drastically to survive, promising Wall Street analysts to bring much design and production back to the United States. With less public drama, General Electric has also changed course. After investing vast amounts in overseas manufacturing plants, America's single greatest industrial corporation is now strengthening its domestic manufacturing base, and its chief executive, Jeffrey Immelt, has been publicly explaining why the country as a whole must do the same. The reality is that manufacturing is inescapable. Few Americans can work in elite fields like corporate management or investment banking. No matter how large these loom in the consciousness of the governing class, most service employment, such as restaurant work, pays low wages. Agriculture is a minuscule employer in all developed nations. And for all the glories of high tech, it remains a modest employer. During the auto industry wreck of 2009, Americans discovered that Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, despite decades of decline, still employed more people than all the famous names of Silicon Valley, from Adobe to Yahoo, combined. As a result, the incomes and living standards of non-poor Americans must largely rise and fall with manufacturing employment. Even if they do not personally work in manufacturing, a strong manufacturing sector is needed to support the labor market and the value of the dollar, on which an import-dependent America now relies for its standard of living, from garments to gasoline. A new American economy is emerging, in which Americans will consume less and save more to rebuild America's capital base, and import less and export more to start retiring America's now vast foreign indebtedness. Indeed, America must do these things unless it intends to confiscate foreign dollar holdings by devaluation. And it is hard to imagine how America can rebuild its manufacturing and rebalance its trade without repudiating free trade to some carefully chosen extent. If nothing else, The need to neutralize foreign mercantilism demands this. This is not just a matter of concern for Americans, because unless foreign demand increases, the global economy must shrink in proportion to falling American demand. So increased American exports are, in fact, the only way to maintain current American imports and thus global demand. It is thus that a dose of American protectionism may soon be precisely what the whole world needs. Edward Luttwak, Chevy Chase, Maryland, November 2009. Dr. Luttwak is the author of Turbo Capitalism, Winners and Losers in the Global Economy, and also The Endangered American Dream, How to Stop the United States from Becoming a Third World Country, and How to Win the Geo-Economic Struggle for Industrial Supremacy. Hi, this is Ian Fletcher, and I'm reading from my book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, What Should Replace It, and Why. I'm going to read from the introduction, Why We Can't Trust the Economists. The introductory quote is this: "Oh yes, I know, we have recently been told by no less than 364 academic economists that such a thing cannot be. Their confidence in the accuracy of their own predictions leaves me breathless. But, having been brought up over the shop, I sometimes wonder whether they pay back their forecasts with their money." Margaret Thatcher, 1981. America's trade deficit, $696 billion in 2008, $701 billion in 2007, and a world record $760 billion in 2006. Even if it did fall by half in 2009, a temporary plunge seen in past recessions that probably doesn't signify underlying improvement, a $370 billion deficit is still astronomical by any reasonable historical standard. To be fair, the trade deficit is not a perfect indicator of free trade's cost. A nation can always balance its trade by crude measures like forcing down wages by political fiat. So, hypothetically, we could have a small deficit and a large trade problem. Plenty of impoverished third world nations have balanced trade, and a single year's deficit means nothing. But with numbers this high, the trade deficit is obviously a big problem, if it's a problem at all. And yet Americans remain afraid to do anything about it. The dangers of protectionism are notorious, and questioning free trade in an intellectually serious way runs into deep waters of economics very fast. So we remain paralyzed in the face of crisis. This book aims to loosen that paralysis a little. Over the last 20 years, Americans have bought over $6 trillion, that's trillion with a T, 6,000 billion, 6 million million, more from the world than we have sold back to it. That's over $20,000 per American. Ironically, if the U.S. were a developing country, our deficits would have reached the 5% level that the International Monetary Fund takes as a benchmark of financial crisis. The U.S. economy has ceased generating any net new jobs in internationally traded sectors, in either manufacturing or services. The comforting myth persists that America is shifting from low-tech to high-tech employment, but we're not. We're losing jobs in both and shifting to non-tradable services, which are mostly low value-added and thus ill-paid jobs. According to the Commerce Department, all our net new jobs are in categories like security guards, waitresses, and the like. The vaunted new economy has not contributed a single net new job to America in this century. Not one. The alchemy of international finance that lets America run a seemingly infinite overdraft against the rest of the world looks suspicious, too. Because that's what it means to endlessly import more than we export. But where does the money come from at the end of the day? Can we really get something for nothing forever? Or are we in for another crisis, like the 2008 financial crisis? Subprime mortgages looked too good to be true, and then they blew up. The aftershocks are still hitting us. Is trade going to be the next shoe to drop? Common sense seems to say that American workers are going to have problems when we trade with nations, like India and China, where the average wage is $1 an hour or less, 57 cents an hour for Chinese manufacturing workers, to be exact. Corporate America even admits, with barely concealed glee, that competition from foreign labor has American workers pinned. As one Goodyear vice president put it, until we get real wage levels down much closer to those of the Brazils and Koreas, we cannot pass along productivity gains to wages and still be competitive. Brazils? Koreas? Our wages? These nations and others are booming as exporters to the United States. But they remain far too poor to take back enough of our exports to balance our trade. Their combination of dreadful wages and regulatory standards on the one hand, and winning economic strategies on the other, has so far produced nothing like the living standards needed to make them significant importers of American goods. Despite recent decades of economic growth, there are still over 1 billion people in Asia earning less than $2 a day. Working conditions are the flip side of low pay in developing countries. Production methods long ago abandoned in the developed world, many of them dangerous and environmentally unsound, are still widely in use. In India, for example, foundry workers often don't wear socks, shoes, protective headgear, earplugs, or even eye protection. Often wearing no more than boxer shorts, they squat on the floor next to the roaring furnaces. Charles Dickens has moved to Asia. The environment is threatened. Thousands of foundries in China run on industrial-grade coke with no pollution control devices on their smokestacks, creating a plume of smoke that stretches across the Pacific on satellite photos. Chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, are banned in the United States, but still used in China as a blowing agent for the production of polyurethane foam cushions and the like, providing a significant cost advantage for Chinese manufacturers. None of this happens by accident. Foreign governments treat trade as war and use every trick in the book, legal and illegal, under international agreements, to grab their industries a competitive advantage. And even when they don't cheat, they are often more skilled in cultivating their industries than we are. Toyota, despite its troubles, somehow didn't go bankrupt when GM did. All these facts impinge upon America because of free trade. But economists keep telling us everything will be fine. According to them, free trade is good for us, and they can prove it. 93% of American economists surveyed support free trade. This inescapably raises the question of whether they've been doing their jobs, and whether America should stick with the policy they recommend. This is a book about real-world economic problems, brutally real problems. But it's also a book about economic theory, because in economics, raw facts don't mean much without a theory to interpret them. This is especially true for parts of economics that are as controversial and theoretically unsettled as trade. Wrong theories helped get America into its current trade mess, so we will need the right theories to get us out of it. Not only theories, of course, but we won't be able to do it without them. Can't we just find a practical solution? That's the instinct of many Americans, who find economic theory abstruse and often baffling. To be fair, sometimes it is. Unfortunately not. To just do what works is only an option when what works is obvious, and in trade, it isn't. Common sense tells us that airplanes shouldn't crash, but it doesn't tell us how to design a plane that will actually fly. It takes a theory called aerodynamics to do that. Luckily, the right economic theories are not all that hard to understand if one makes the effort. And, as we shall see, all this theory has a payoff in the form of an implied solution. At an absolute minimum, ordinary citizens need to know enough about the economics that supposedly justifies free trade to hold their ground in confrontations with the experts and not get ruled out of public debate on grounds of ignorance. America can't be a democracy if one side is intimidated into silence on a question this important. So, ordinary citizens need to learn how to criticize the economics of free trade in language that economists, and those who look to them for policy advice, accept as legitimate, and will have to take seriously. But first, we're going to look at why we shouldn't just defer to what economists tell us. Because if we can, then we should just leave our trade problems to these experts, and books like this one have no place. So, understanding what's wrong with economists is our first step. Some people believe economists are irrelevant, and that free trade is American policy simply because big corporations and other vested interests have the political muscle to impose it. This is false. For a start, without economics, vested interests can't tell whether free trade benefits them or not, just as a company can't know whether or not it is profitable without resort to accounting principles. Vested interests can indeed see money piling up in their bank accounts under free trade. But is this more or less money than what they would have gotten without free trade? Without economics, they can't tell. When a policy has complex effects, it is not obvious who wins and loses from it, even to the winners and losers themselves, and especially in the long run. They have to analyze trade policy to know this, and one can't analyze any economic policy without theories about how the economy works. This is why the British economist John Maynard Keynes born 1883, died 1946, arguably the greatest economist of the 20th century, wrote that the ideas of economists and philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men, who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences, are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. I am sure the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. But, soon or late, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good or evil. Furthermore, vested interests are not infinitely powerful. They have to persuade the rest of the country, especially Congress, to go along with the policies they want. Despite political corruption, all the money in the world couldn't bribe Congress to pass a law requiring people to roller skate to work. Legislation always requires some non-laughable justification. Therefore, lobbying successfully for free trade requires credible economic ideas that support it. This is why the famous liberal economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, winner of the 2008 Nobel Prize for his work on trade, and a thinker we will draw upon extensively in this book, wrote of his stint in government, "What was more surprising was the way that even strong political considerations could sometimes be held at bay when a proposal seemed clearly without a good analytical foundation. I know of one corporation that had a demand widely supported by other businesses and highly placed friends in the government, yet got nowhere for more than a year, largely because the company's arguments were so easily torn apart by government economists. In the end, the corporation hired some high-quality economists to help produce a well-argued report, and for that or other reasons, finally got some action." So, even if free trade economics is largely a bundle of rationalizations, these are still rationalizations the system needs in order to function. It follows that if opponents of free trade can debunk these rationalizations, these opponents can deprive free traders of camouflage, credibility, and self-confidence they can ill afford to lose. That is one purpose of this book. To be completely fair, to some extent economists haven't been wrong about free trade at all. But the aforementioned 7% who know better have allowed a mistaken impression of the disciplinary consensus to be foisted upon the public. And when the other 93% say they support free trade, this doesn't necessarily mean they support it without reservation. It often just means that they know it has problems, but support it over any likely alternative, which they fear would be worse. Above all, economists fear that admitting the known problems with free trade might provoke politicians into doing something stupid. As the 19th century American radical economist Henry George put it, "Introducing a tariff bill into a Congress or Parliament is like throwing a banana into a cage of monkeys." The great fear is that if protectionism is conceded any legitimacy, special interests will seize control and economic logic will fall by the wayside. For example, Congress might enact a 30% tariff on imported steel to save Rust Belt jobs that would be disappearing soon due to technological change anyway. This could cost $300,000 per job per year, including the cost of making American manufacturers pay more for steel than their foreign competitors. Then every other industry would want in, and before we knew it, we would have a crazy quilt industrial policy, set by congressional log rolling and lobbyist bidding wars. It would be a mess, based on political pull, embodying no rational economic strategy, and costing our economy hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Fear of such a debacle gets most, not all, economists off the hook for outright incompetence or dishonesty. But it reveals a deeper problem. This fear is not actually a part of economic science. It is just a somewhat cynical intuition about the American political system. Economists are certainly entitled to their political intuitions, which may even be true, but these intuitions are not part of their actual knowledge as economists. They are not something that they have PhD-level expertise in, and the rest of us don't. They are thus not privileged over the intuitions of ordinary informed citizens. The electorate has a right to hear both sides of the debate and make its own decision. That's democracy. Economists' fears may also be false. Our government is sometimes corrupt and stupid, but it's also sometimes effective. The country wouldn't still be here if it wasn't. Some foreign governments certainly seem to have had effective protectionist policies in recent decades, using tariffs and non-tariff barriers to boost their economies. Japan clearly did not become the second richest nation in the world practicing free trade. China is conceded from one end of the political spectrum to the other to thumb its nose at free trade, but it is booming. Even Europe seems to handle these matters better than we do. Germanic and Scandinavian Europe, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland, usually run healthy surpluses, and the Eurozone as a whole has had its trade within pocket change of balance since the euro was created in 1999. 13 European countries now pay their factory workers better than we do, and Germany, not China, was the world's largest exporter as late as 2008. Do all these countries know something we don't? Cynical comments about politicians are also an evasion. In America, we elected them. So what they do ultimately reflects what we want. If we voters are corrupt and vote for short-term gratification, something for nothing, and sweet deals for our own special interests, then the politicians we elect will be corrupt too. But if we wise up, and a sense of national crisis engenders a sense of national purpose, then we may demand and get a trade policy sufficiently honest and rational to work. This has happened on other issues before. Economists can be corrupt too. Some are simply paid shills of special interests. Economics consulting firms like Global Insight, MICRA, and Strategic Policy Research basically retail the service of providing whatever conclusions are required, albeit with sufficient sophistication that nobody has to tell any literal lies. Sometimes the corruption is more subtle, cumulative, and unconscious. Indeed, it is rarely a matter of, say X, and we'll pay you Y. In order to win clients, economists in private practice, the author used to be one, must cultivate a reputation for saying the kinds of things clients want to hear. Certain ideas, like rising inequality or the problems of free trade, are just best avoided. They are not economically correct. So they drop out of circulation and don't get the attention they deserve. A few years of that is all it takes to skew the consensus, as ignoring facts is just as effective as denying them. Indeed, it is more so, as it avoids starting a fight that might attract unwanted attention. As a result, the age-old question of whether bad policy comes from corruption or bad thinking doesn't really have an answer, as these two phenomena are intimately entwined. Corruption inexorably debases the quality of thinking over time, and a nation that insists on being told what it wants to hear will eventually lose the ability to figure out what the actual truth is. And, of course, sometimes financial bullying and other outright coercion does occur. Economist Paul Craig Roberts, an assistant Treasury Secretary under Reagan, and today one of the most distinguished critics of free trade, reports seeing, when he was a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, memos analyzing what grants that think tank could obtain from the administration of George Bush Sr. in exchange for firing him. He had displeased the administration by criticizing its economic policies. Bush's science advisor, Alan Brumley, was forbidden to talk to the media for 6 months in 1991 after he told the Wall Street Journal that America needed an industrial policy. In 2003, the Defense Department temporarily shut down its own advisory group on electron devices after this group released a report detailing the destruction of U.S. innovation capabilities in electronics by imports. And Bruce Bartlett, one of the early figures of Reagan's supply-side economics, was fired by the conservative National Center for Policy Analysis in 2005 for denouncing George Bush Jr. as a conservative imposter, later publishing a book with that title. Who pays the piper will certainly try to call the tune. No government likes to hear bad news, and shooting the messenger remains one of the favored ways of making bad news go away. Conversely, sometimes the powers that be simply avoid the topic of trade problems entirely. For example, in the four presidential and vice presidential debates of the 2008 campaign, imports were never mentioned. The trade deficit was never mentioned, and exports were mentioned only once. China, by contrast, was mentioned 15 times, geopolitical rivalry being much more exciting than economics. This all raises an important question. Do America's rulers secretly know that they're making a mess with free trade, but go on doing it for profit's sake? Or do they sincerely believe in this policy? The author cannot pretend to be privy to anyone's private thoughts, but it seems to vary by individual. Most such people, especially those whose professional expertise isn't in economics, genuinely believe in the free trade consensus. They instinctively defer to the officially anointed experts, and these all tell them free trade is correct. And establishmentarians who are economists by training are usually among the 93% who believe in free trade. Even those who are among the 7% who don't usually keep their mouths shut for career reasons. Change is also resisted simply because it is change. In the words of Gregory Tassie, a senior economist at the National Institute of Standards who has criticized free trade economics, those with a stake in the status quo and their defenders in government argue for old models of competitive strategy and economic growth. Specifically, factions with vested interests in economic assets such as physical and intellectual capital, existing labor skills, or simply a fear of the trauma and the cost of change resist adaptation. This is the installed base effect, and it is widespread. But just as the best minds in the Kremlin never really believed in Marxism, some members of America's establishment are well aware of the harm free trade is doing. They are not stupid people, after all, especially when it comes to money, and, as we shall see, the analyses that reveal that free trade isn't working are not that hard to do. One can sometimes see glimpses of their awareness if one pays attention. This book is littered with quotes from prominent people who have obviously grasped one aspect or another of the defects of free trade, even if they shy away from publicly conceding any recognition of the whole. Eccentric billionaires, who can afford not to care what other members of the establishment think of them, are another highly visible dissident group. Warren Buffett and Ross Perot in the U.S., and the late Sir James Goldsmith in the U.K., are the best known. We will look at some of Buffett's ideas in Chapter 11. Academic economists versus the real world. Some academic economists are enervated by sheer ivory tower indifference to the real world. They are trapped in a circular system of publication and promotion procedures that tends to reinforce groupthink. They get published by impressing more senior economists, and they get promoted based on how much they publish. Their careers are determined by their ability to impress other academics, so it's risky for them to wade into the murky waters of public debate. Nobody gets tenure for picking fights with the Wall Street Journal. Academic economists often say things that people who actually deal with the realities of trade for a living, executives, diplomats, trade union officials, find they cannot take seriously without risking their own unemployment. Even economists employed by business schools are notorious for being out of sync with other economists on trade. This is no accident, as they have to peddle theories that actually work in practice, which economics department economists generally do not. Among other things, business school economists are much more likely to see international trade as a rivalry between nations, with winners and losers, than our economics department economists, who tend to see the jungle of commerce as a beautiful rainforest where everybody wins. If engineers and physicists did not see eye to eye, might we not start questioning physics? For example, it has been obvious for 35 years now that America's economy needs to be internationally competitive. But many academic economists disparage the very concept of competitiveness, mainly because it has no accepted definition. And indeed it hasn't, for the simple reason that all competition is defined by winning and losing, and there's no obvious standard for what it would mean for America to win in international economic competition. But that doesn't mean America doesn't have to be competitive. Happiness doesn't have a clear definition either. When one scratches the editorial page surface of economics and comes face to face with its intellectual core, one finds a mass of equations, This gives it the appearance of hard fact. How could anything so mathematical be a matter of opinion? It also looks distinctly like something which people who don't understand it should keep their mouths shut about. But, in fact, sophisticated math is actually overrated as an economic tool, as hinted by the fact that hedge funds employing it fared no better than others in the financial meltdown of 2008. The over-reliance of contemporary economics upon sophisticated math creates a number of problems. The fundamental one is that because it's easier to mathematize some ideas than others, some ideas appear truer than they really are. But the presumption physics enjoys that mathematically elegant theories are more likely to be true simply doesn't hold in economics, however much many economists may want it to. The aggressive use of simplifying assumptions can deliver elegant math on demand, but only at the price of misrepresenting reality. Theories that favor free trade tend to be mathematically neat, mainly because they assume markets are perfectly efficient, which makes their outcomes predictable. Theories which favor protectionism, on the other hand, tend to be mathematically messy, mainly because they assume markets are not perfectly efficient and thus not predictable. So, economists have often favored free trade simply because the math is neater. As Paul Krugman once put it, the theory of international trade followed the perceived line of least mathematical resistance. There's actually a serious paradox here, because intellectual rigor, which math provides in spades, certainly sounds like a self-evidently good thing. Unfortunately, intellectual rigor can only guarantee that reasoning is internally consistent. Its conclusions, that is, follow from its premises. It cannot guarantee that those premises were right in the first place, and with bad premises, even the most rigorous reasoning will produce nonsense. Premises don't even have to be wrong to generate false conclusions. They only have to be incomplete. And no set of premises can prove its own completeness. The more mathematically abstruse economics gets, the more basic truths get obscured behind a blizzard of symbols, making it easy to wander into falsehoods unawares for lack of an obvious sanity check. Formal mathematical modeling of the economy, where these distortions reside, should be viewed as a tool, not as identical with economics as such, an error common in the profession since World War II. Sometimes modeling can be very revealing, but sometimes it conceals realities that are hard to wrap math around. Sometimes it can even destroy knowledge when it prevents important facts from being recognized simply because they are hard to mathematize. Some of the most insightful recent work in economics, by thinkers like 2009 Nobelist Oliver Williamson, Harvard Business School's Michael Porter, Tokyo-based financial journalist Eamon Fingleton, and Norwegian economist Erik Reinert, barely uses it. The economic technocrats of Beijing, Tokyo, and Seoul, who have produced amazing economic achievements in recent decades, have shown almost no interest in it at all, beyond basic statistics. Economics has some problems understanding the effects of free trade, simply because it is a social science, and therefore value-free. Many people are surprised to learn this, but there is actually nothing in economics that holds that prosperity is better than poverty, any more than neuroanatomy holds that pleasure is better than pain. And yet economics uses terms such as efficient, which certainly sound like value judgments. So when economists say that free trade is efficient, this actually has a narrowly technical meaning with limited connection to national economic well-being, as most people would understand it. Conversely, economics also has its true believers, for whom the infallibility of free markets, of which free trade is a part, is a beautiful idea, a secular religion, like Marxism once was. The libertarian Cato Institute in Washington is their Vatican, and the old Ayn Rand cult of objectivism is their fundamentalist sect. But these people are just trying to pass off political ideology as if it were economics. It is simply not the same thing. A discipline dealing in observable facts, like economics, is not an appropriate object of faith, which rightly pertains to religious subjects and other non-empirical matters. If economic facts are observable, then observation should determine what we think about them. Nobody should have faith in free markets, or in their opposites for that matter. They should have evidence either way, or not hold an opinion. The Cold War gave Americans a terrible habit of turning economics into a quasi-theological clash of absolute values. Economists take decades to get things right. They have been criticizing free trade on and off since it was first advocated near the dawn of modern capitalism 400 years ago. However, the current wave of academic critique is relatively young. New trade theory, the blandly named but path-breaking critique that is the academic foundation of Part 3 of this book, emerged in the late 1970s. But it only achieved its breakthrough synthesis in 2000, with Ralph Gummery and William Baumol's brilliant little book, Global Trade and Conflicting National Interests, whose ideas we will explore in Chapter 10. Because it takes time to gather data and think through objections, decades may pass before a new insight becomes the general consensus of the discipline. So it may still be a while before the economics profession as a whole digests these innovations and changes its mind about free trade. Right now, the slowly crumbling consensus in economics mainly derives from work that reached acceptance in the 1980s. This was the heyday of free market economists, Milton Friedman and others, who did brilliant work debunking the liberal Keynesian consensus under which they grew up. That consensus, which was gospel from the 1940s to the 1960s, broke down under the stagflation of the 1970s and was a product of the Great Depression. It had itself overturned an even older consensus derived from the laissez-faire, gold standard world of the late 19th century. In the 1960s, when the political consensus was Keynesian, the profession was Keynesian. In the 1980s, when free markets resurged in political popularity under Reagan and Thatcher, economics was in eager support with so-called efficient markets theory. Neither of these ideas, in its orthodox form, is taken seriously by very many economists today. This suggests that economists are suspiciously reliable sock puppets of the political status quo. and that their reasoning is not as different from the thinking of ordinary concerned citizens as their intimidating academic facade might suggest. Some economists give unhelpful answers about free trade simply because they don't think the national economic interest matters. Technically, they are of course correct that choosing America as the entity whose economic well-being one cares about is arbitrary, from the point of view of pure economics. There is nothing in economic science that privileges whatever nation lies between the 49th parallel and the Rio Grande. But this is an attitude of little practical use to a nation in serious economic trouble. As economist Herman Daly of the University of Maryland, best known for his work on ecological economics, puts it, "Free trade makes it very hard to deal with these root causes at a national level, which is the only level at which effective social controls over the economy exist." Because we have a national government, because Americans care about what happens to their economy, and because it is the national debate on the question that will bring changes, or fail to, our trade problems will be fixed in Washington, or not at all. Globally, for good or ill, the nation-state is still where the buck of political legitimacy stops. Higher and lower political entities, from Kansas to the United Nations, enjoy legitimacy only because nation-states have given it to them. So even if other instruments for controlling the world economy can be developed over time, the nation-state will be the bottleneck for developing them. A blanket rejection of even the mildest economic nationalism, an attitude common at both extremes of the political spectrum, simply hands a blank check to multinational corporations, foreign powers, and distorted market forces to do as they please. At an absolute minimum, economics should not be abused to, quote, prove the inappropriateness of caring about national economic well-being, something it does not do. From the point of view of pure economics, internationalist assumptions are just as arbitrary as nationalist ones. People who reject the national economic interest should do so openly, not hide behind theoretical constructs that do this on the sly. The ultimate value of nationalism versus internationalism is a value judgment beyond the scope of this book. A nonpartisan, soft economic nationalism is postulated herein simply to make the critique tractable. As the problems with free trade become clearest when one asks how a given nation may be helped or harmed by it. The only thing this kind of nationalism insists upon is that a nation's economy should basically be run for the benefit of its people. It has no ideological commitments with regard to other uses of the term nationalism, and leaves open to partisan debate the best way to realize its objectives. As we shall see, the trade solutions America needs could be implemented by either party and painted in a wide variety of ideological colors. Some of the analysis in this book is more relevant to other nations than to the U.S., simply because it applies to economic circumstances that obtain there more than here. We will, for example, take a long, hard look at why free trade is bad for developing countries. Whether the policy implications of these analyses are also good for America depends on the analysis in question. This is not a univocally America First book, simply because not every valid critique of free trade implies policies that would be in America's interests. Other nations have the right to play the game for their own benefit and seek the well-being of their own people, too. Free trade is so problematic that easily half the world has something to gain by ending it. There's no point foreclosing the scope of our analysis just to avoid discovering holes in free trade that will help Costa Rica more than ourselves. But don't worry, America is going to get plenty out of ending free trade. Hi, this is Ian Fletcher, and I'm reading from my book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, What Should Replace It, and Why. This is Chapter 1, The Bad Arguments for Free Trade. Before we delve into the defective economics of free trade, we must clear away a considerable mass of accumulated intellectual debris. The issue is bound up in the public mind with a lot of extraneous questions, so we must disentangle it from these if we are ever to think straight about it. For a start, we are not debating whether cosmopolitanism is a good thing. In many ways it is, but it is a cultural question with little to do with the actual hard economics of international trade. Neither are we debating the choice between, in the words of New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, the Lexus and the olive tree. That is, between the efficient but soulless rationalism of the global marketplace and the rooted particularism of nations and communities. The economics itself of free trade is legitimately controversial, so there's no justification for bracketing it as a settled question and turning to imponderables like the relative value of prosperity versus heritage. We are also not debating globalization as such, an historical process, or globalism, the ideology that favors globalization. Though it has ramifications that affect almost everything, free trade is, strictly speaking, a purely economic question. And globalization involves a lot more than economics. It includes cultural exchanges, population movements, global governance, the global environment, and many other things. So one can certainly oppose free trade and support globalization with respect to its non-economic aspects, or vice versa, for that matter. Even a certain amount of economic globalization is perfectly compatible with ending free trade. If every nation on Earth imposed a 10% tariff, this would end free trade by definition, but the world would still be globalizing economically, albeit in a slower and more controlled fashion than today. It has been estimated that the spread of air freight had the same effect as a tariff cut from 32 to 9% in the U.S. from 1950 to 1998. But no ideological energy is expended on the problem of air freight pricing. Economic globalization is a choice. It is often debated as something that is either good or bad, and will either succeed or fail. But framing the alternatives as binary is too crude and tends to force uncritical approval on both counts. It encourages the assumption that we must make globalization succeed, and as a unitary package, with no choice about its different aspects being possible. The better questions to ask are, how far will economic globalization go? What shape will it take? And what measures, if any, should we take to influence either? If economic globalization is a good thing, then it should be able to survive our getting a choice about how far it is allowed to go. Attempts to foreclose that choice betray a distinct nervousness about what people might choose on the part of those who would foreordain the outcome, usually in favor of a radically laissez-faire result. The tragedy of free trade is that it gives up some of the best tools humanity has to shape what kind of economic globalization we get: tariffs and non-tariff trade barriers. There simply are not that many levers over the world economy that are both feasible to pull and have a large impact. If we rule out some of the best, we haven't got many left. The fundamental message of this book is that nations, including the U.S., should seek strategic, not unconditional, integration with the rest of the world economy. Economic openness, like most things in life, is valuable up to a point, but not beyond it. Fairly open trade, most of the time, is justified. Absolutely free trade, 100% of the time, is an extremist position and is not. The difference between the two is rational protectionism. Valid economics simply doesn't support the extravagant notion that, in the words of techno-utopian Wired magazine, open, good, closed, bad, tattoo it on your forehead, apply it to technology standards, to business strategies, to philosophies of life. It's the winning concept for individuals, for nations, for the global community in the years ahead. Nations need instead a well-chosen balance between openness and closure towards the larger world economy. One giveaway sign that laissez-faire in foreign trade, which is what free trade is wrong, is that laissez-faire hasn't been taken seriously in America's domestic economy for well over 100 years, since before the era of Teddy Roosevelt's trustbusters around the turn of the 20th century. Despite perennial posturing to the contrary by free market ideologues, we have, in fact, found reasonable levels of regulation in most parts of our economy to be best. Neither outright state control nor absolute economic freedom. It is no accident that regulating international trade was well within the intention of the Founding Fathers. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution explicitly authorizes Congress, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations. It is often said, or tacitly assumed, that in today's world, free trade is somehow inevitable. But if so, why do its supporters bother arguing for it so aggressively? The inevitability of free trade certainly does not follow from the apparent inevitability of some form of capitalism, given the long history of protectionist capitalist economies. The U.S. itself used to be one, as we will see in Chapter 6. Contrary to myth, modern history simply has not been a one-way escalator to ever-increasing global economic interconnectedness. Instead, this interconnectedness has ebbed and flowed upon larger political currents. It was pushed up by colonialism, but pushed down when former colonies like the U.S. and India adopted protectionist policies of their own after independence. It was pushed down by fascism on the right and socialism on the left, but it was pushed up by the Cold War. Prior to the 1970s, the peak of world trade as a percentage of world economic output was in 1914, a peak to which it did not return for two generations. This flux is not an idle curiosity of unrepeatable history. Anyone who assumes world trade can only go up in the long run should consider what peak oil or tightening environmental constraints may do to transport costs. Neither has increased trade always correlated with increased prosperity and its decline with the reverse. The world economy was actually less globalized in 1960 than in 1910, but it was more prosperous. Modern technology does not mandate free trade either. While technology indeed favors the expansion of trade by reducing shipping and transaction costs, it doesn't mandate that this trade be free rather than subject to tariffs. Indeed, if technology erodes natural trade barriers like distance, and trade barriers are sometimes beneficial, as we will see below, then modern technology can, paradoxically, increase the justification for tariffs. All inevitability arguments are moral evasions anyhow, because offloading responsibility to the free market ignores the fact that we choose whether to have and how much we regulate markets. This is probably what the great protectionist president Teddy Roosevelt was driving at when he wrote that pernicious indulgence in the doctrine of free trade seems inevitably to produce fatty degeneration of the moral fiber. It is sometimes suggested that free trade is a moot question because globalization has made the nation-state irrelevant. As Doug Oliver of the Cessna Aircraft Company recently said, in response to complaints about his company outsourcing its entry-level skycatcher plane to a firm that supplies China's Air Force, "Nothing is American anymore. Nothing is German anymore. Nothing is Japanese anymore. Harley-Davidson sources parts from all around the world. Let's face it, we're in a global economy." This is all technically true, with respect to the sourcing of parts at least, but it misses the point. Even if the internationality of modern supply chains means that America's trade balance adds up at the component rather than finished product level, we still run a deficit or a surplus. And even if who builds which finished products isn't the key to prosperity anymore, who builds which components increasingly is. In any case, the nation-state is a long way from being economically irrelevant. Most fundamentally, it remains relevant to people because most people still live in the nation where they were born, which means that their economic fortunes depend upon wage and consumption levels within that one society. Capital is a similar story. Even in the early 21st century, it hasn't been globalized nearly as much as often imagined. And it also cares very much about where it lives, frequently for the same reasons people do. Few people wish to live or invest in Malawi. Many people wish to live and invest in California. For a start, because 70% of America's capital is human capital, a lot of capital behaves exactly as people do, simply because it is people. Another 12% is estimated to be social capital, the value of institutions and knowledge not assignable to individuals. So, although liquid financial capital can indeed flash around the world in the blink of an electronic eye, this is only a fraction, under 10%, of any developed nation's capital stock. Even most non-human capital resides in things like real estate, infrastructure, physical plant, and types of financial capital that don't flow overseas, or don't flow very much. Economists call this don't flow very much phenomenon home bias, and it is well documented. As a result, the output produced by all this capital is still largely tied to particular nations. So although, for reasons we will examine in detail later, capital mobility certainly causes big problems of its own, it is nowhere near big enough to literally abolish the nation-state as an economic unit. Will it do so one day? Even this is unlikely. Even where famously dematerializing and globalizing assets, like fiber optic telecom lines, are added, assets that supposedly make physical location irrelevant, they are still largely added where existing agglomerations of capital are. For example, although fiber optic backbones have gone into places like Bangalore, India, which were not global economic centers a generation ago, big increments of capacity have also gone into places like Manhattan, Tokyo, Silicon Valley, and Hong Kong, which were already important. As a result, existing agglomerations of capital are largely self-reinforcing and here to stay, even if new ones come into being in unexpected places. And these agglomerations have national shape because of past history. Legacy effects can be extremely durable. Previous technological revolutions, like the worldwide spread of railroads, were at least as big as current innovations like the Internet, and they didn't abolish the nation-state. Ironically, the enduring relevance of the national economy is clearest in some of the poster child countries of globalization, like Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, and Ireland. In each of these nations, economic success was the product of policies enacted by governments that were in some sense nationalist. Japan industrialized after the Meiji Restoration of 1868 to avoid being colonized by some Western power. Taiwan did it out of fear of mainland China. South Korea did it out of fear of North Korea. Ireland did it to escape economic domination by England. In each case, the driving force was not simply desire for profit. This exists in every society, including resource-rich basket cases like Nigeria, where it merely produces gangsterism, but does not reliably crystallize into the policies needed for economic growth. The driving force was national political needs, which found a solution in economic development. There's no getting around politics. Politics is still mostly practiced at the national level, and practiced with sovereignty only at that level. And the reality for almost all people and corporations is that national policies still matter. It matters whether one has good physical infrastructure and basic security. it matters whether one must constantly pay bribes to get things done. It matters whether one gets cut out of the best opportunities in favor of political cronies. It matters whether the local education system produces quality employees. It matters whether one has a sound currency to work with. It matters whether the local population reveres things like science, efficiency, and entrepreneurship. And it matters whether the politicians in charge of all these things are wise enough to keep them that way, and whether the voters, if the country's a democracy, are wise enough to elect the right politicians. Globalization doesn't make all these things less important, let alone irrelevant. They are arguably even more important in a more globalized world, because the rewards for getting them right and the punishments for getting them wrong are larger. Without globalization, mediocre industries can just sputter along for decades. But with globalization, these industries can get wiped out. But they can also conquer the world if they're not mediocre. So national policies are arguably more important than ever. There is an important related factor. As Michael Porter, one of the most distinguished faculty members of Harvard Business School, has observed, competitive advantage is created and sustained through a highly localized process. Differences in national economic structures, values, cultures, institutions, and histories contribute profoundly to competitive success. The role of the home nation seems to be as strong or even stronger than ever. While globalization of competition might appear to make the nation less important, instead, it seems to make it more so. So, what we can call economic national character matters. One sign of this is that even multinational corporations are almost always strongly tied to particular nations. Despite the myth of the stateless corporation, only a few dozen firms worldwide maintain over half their production facilities abroad. According to one study, multinational companies typically have two-thirds of their assets in their home country or region, and sell about the same proportion in their home country or region. Another meticulous 2008 study bluntly concluded that globalization as properly understood does not exist. For example, there is no evidence that U.S. firms operate globally. Instead, they both produce and sell on a home region basis, as do multinational enterprises from Europe and Asia. So, whatever else multinational corporations may be guilty of, vanishing into denationalized thin air isn't it. Economic nationalism is usually held up by free traders as a dumb and reactionary force. Sometimes, of course, it is. Boneheaded economic nationalism belongs in the junkyard of history with the other ideologies rusting there. Nothing in this book is intended to defend it. But economic nationalism can also be a smart, technocratic, forward-looking force. Indeed, one of the key things that makes economic globalization work when implemented correctly. Nations with weak or fragmented national cohesion, such as Nigeria, Afghanistan, or Iraq, haven't exactly seized the opportunities of the global economy lately. Neither in the U.S. have we? The cliché that we live in a borderless global economy does not survive serious examination. Because the U.S. is roughly 25% of the world economy, a truly borderless world would imply that imports and exports would each make up 75% of our economy, since our purchase and sale transactions would be distributed around the world. This would entail a total trade level, that is, imports plus exports, of 150% of GDP. Instead, our total trade level is 29%. Imports are 17%, and exports are 12%. So, our economy is nowhere near borderless, and as our trade is almost certainly destined to be balanced by import contraction rather than an export boom in the next few years, our trade level is almost certainly poised to go down, not up. A truly unified world economy would mean that rates of interest and profit, for example, would have to be equal everywhere, or the differences would be arbitraged away by the financial markets. But this is nowhere near being the case. Even between adjacent and similar nations like the U.S. and Canada, national borders still count. The Canadian economist John McCallum has documented that trade between Canadian provinces is, on average, 20 times as large as the corresponding trade between Canadian provinces and American states. It has been estimated that the average cost of international trade, ignoring tariffs, is the equivalent of a 170% tariff, of which 55% is local distribution costs and 74% is international trade costs. Much of international trade is interregional anyway, not global, being centered on European, North American, and East Asian blocs. This is true for just under 50% of both agriculture and manufactured goods. In reality, the world economy remains what it has been for a very long time: a thin crust of genuinely global economy, more visible than its true size due to its concentration in media, finance, technology, and luxury goods, over a network of regionally linked national economies, over vast sectors of every economy that are not internationally traded at all. 70% of the U.S. economy, for example, falls into this category. On present trends, things will remain roughly this way for the rest of our lives. The world economy in the early 21st century is not even remotely borderless. Let's talk about free trade foreign policy for a minute. Free traders since 19th century classical liberals like the English Richard Cobden and the French Frederick Bastiat have promised that free trade would bring world peace. Even the World Trade Organization, the WTO, has been known to make this cheery claim, but it does not survive historical scrutiny. Britain, the most freely trading major nation of the 19th century, fought more wars than any other power, sometimes openly with the aim of imposing free trade on reluctant nations. That's how Hong Kong became British. Post-World War II Japan has been blatantly protectionist, but has had a more peaceful foreign policy than free trading America. In reality, free trade sometimes dampens international conflict, but it sometimes exacerbates it too. It enriches belligerent autocrats and helps them dodge democratic reforms. Today, for example, it strengthens the Chinese military by building up China's economy and expanding its access to military technology through both trade and through purchases of American technology companies with the money earned thereby. Attempts to link free trade to counterterrorism don't stand up well either. The U.S. is the world's leading free trader, but somehow the world's biggest terrorist target anyway. Free trade's widespread global unpopularity combines with the perception that America is behind it to antagonize peoples and governments around the world just as often as it rallies them to our side. Occasionally, free trade may bribe foreign governments to cooperate with the United States, but it also enriches nations like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, whose elites are knee-deep in funding terrorism and other international mischief. Hard-coding free trade is a legal obligation, as the WTO does, frustrates our ability to use trade concessions as leverage to win foreign cooperation against our enemies. Ironically, the Central Intelligence Agency seems to grasp many of these problems better than the supposedly economics-oriented agencies of the U.S. government. In its Global Trends 2015 report, the agency warns that the process of globalization will be rocky, marked by chronic financial volatility and a widening economic divide. Regions, countries, and groups feeling left behind will face deepening economic stagnation, political instability, and cultural alienation. They will foster political, ethnic, ideological, and religious extremism, along with the violence that often accompanies it. Within countries, the gap in the standard of living will also increase. Increased trade links and the integration of global financial markets will quickly transmit turmoil in one economy, regionally and internationally. Neither does free trade promote human rights. If China had to rely upon domestic demand to drive its economy, locking up its population as factory slaves wouldn't be such a viable strategy. The same goes in other nations, and free trade agreements then frustrate attempts to impose sanctions on human rights violators. The sanctions imposed on South Africa in 1986, for example, would be illegal today under WTO rules. Let's look at some of the flashy, empty arguments for free trade that one hears sometimes. Some arguments for free trade are sheer intellectual fluff, like the idea we should engage in it because it embodies the spirit of the age, the tide of history, or some other contemporary repackaging of these shop-worn ideas. Magazines like the libertarian Reason, techno-utopian Wired, and entrepreneurship-oriented Fast Company reveled in such themes all through the dot-com boom years of the late 1990s. The hallmark here is loose, breathless prose whose actual analytical content dissolves among vague terms and hyperbolic assertions. Remember the quote about open good, closed bad? The aim, above all, here is to make free trade hip, the wave of the future. But free trade's hard economics is just 19th century laissez-faire, the economics of the iron law of wages. its intellectual kernel is David Ricardo's 1817 theory of comparative advantage. Its rival, so-called new trade theory, is, by contrast, a genuinely modern, indeed 21st century, school of thought. Free trade is far too old to be parading itself as the latest thing. Skepticism about free trade is often stigmatized with ad hominem attacks. These mostly come down to variations on the following. Protectionists are dummies, losers, incompetents, hippies, rednecks, dinosaurs, closet socialists, or crypto-fascists. Here, for example, is free trader Barack Obama's version, delivered to an audience of campaign donors in the exclusive Pacific Heights neighborhood of San Francisco while seeking the Democratic nomination in 2008. You go into these small towns in Pennsylvania and, like a lot of small towns in the Midwest, the jobs have been gone now for 25 years and nothing's replaced them. And it's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. God forbid the unemployed of an old-line industrial state should think trade has anything to do with their problems. How silly of them. But economic logic isn't even really the issue here, as these arguments are really aimed at people who don't even try to understand economics, but do care immensely about their social status. The media are saturated with this attitude. Thus, magazine articles on trade problems focus on the unemployed, implying that only life's losers oppose free trade, and that their unemployment is probably their own fault anyway. The careers of people whose jobs are being lost to offshoring? Mere drudgery. Their lives are obviously nothing much worth worrying about. They're not like us here in Pacific Heights. This is largely just a chic veil thrown over class bias. Despite the documented center-left preferences of most journalists on social and cultural issues, on economic issues, including trade, they lean right. A late 1990s survey by the watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting found, for example, that only on environment-related economic issues were they to the left of the public.